So it's a mindfulness walk. It's a slow walk. It can be anywhere from a half an hour to 2 hours, depending on who wants to walk. But it's usually hotel groups, corporate clients, individuals, activations for brands, whether it be a shoe company or what have you, or beauty company that want to get people outside. So it's a way for me just to kind of educate with people, like what's happening to the human body and the brain when we do experience beauty. What is it that's bringing in this this calmness that's coming over us? So thankfully, I had been studying for so long about the brain on beauty, the brain on nature, what's going on. It's been so when I get to do that, I love hearing the oohs and ahs saying, I knew it always felt good, but no one ever told me why. So I'm basically giving them permission. That's what I feel like I've always been just able to be that conduit to giving people permission to slow down and take witness of what they're feeling in their bodies.
I'm Brandon Vaidyanathan, and this is Beauty at Work, a podcast about how beauty shapes our world and the work that we do. In this season, we're looking at beauty in science. This episode is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. More about them later in the show.
Hi, everyone, and welcome. I'm so delighted to have my guest here today, Jennifer Walsh. Jennifer is an acclaimed entrepreneur, author, and media figure who spent more than 25 years working at the intersection of beauty, retail, nature, and neuroscience to help people flourish. She founded Beauty Bar in the 1990s, America's first experiential retail brand incorporating biophilic design, which was later acquired by Amazon in 2011. And in 2016, she launched Walk with Walsh, a video series set in Central Park, exploring the human connection to nature. And this led to her deeper research into the effects of beauty and nature on the body and brain, culminating in her Wellness Walks program, which combines mindfulness and biophilic education. She's the author of the popular wellness journal, Walk Your Way Calm, and the podcast co-host of Biophilic Solutions, Nature Has the Answers. Jennifer guides organizations globally on biophilic design and the importance of experiencing beauty and nature each and every day for optimal health. Jennifer, it's so great to see you and to meet you. Your work is so inspiring. I'm so delighted we could have a conversation.
The feeling is so very mutual. So I'm so honored to be a part of this platform with you because I have loved listening to your guests and the stories that you have and beautiful conversations that really kind of expand our minds, which I think is really important.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, yeah, I'm really delighted. Let me ask you a little bit about your background. The first thing that I want to ask you about was your twin sister, who in many ways I think inspires your biophilia. Could you say a little bit about her and your journey together?
Sure. So thank you for asking about her. Danielle is really special. She is my twin sister. I'm the older sister. So I say I'm older, so I'm cooler or whatever. No, she's my North Star. She's an angel to me. She's been in a group home since we were two. So she is profoundly disabled. She has no access to really use her legs, her arms. She can speak a little bit, but it's more of a mental capacity of a 6-month-old. So okay. At a very early age, I was able to kind of understand what it was like to have someone with such special needs, beautiful needs that have really taught me so much about the world. She didn't have to say anything to me, but I learned so much about life from her, from what she shared just by being silent and just teaching me empathy and kindness and compassion all the time. And so a lot of what I do and everywhere I've ever been in my life, I've always thought that I do it for both of us. She'll never have the ability to walk or run or see the places that I get to see. So when I bear witness to beauty every single day, I know she's next to me all the time.
Mm-hmm. And she loves being outdoors, right? Was that something that got you?
She does. It's really, oh my God, Brandon, I'm so glad you said that because it's so cute when she's in her wheelchair. I mean, she relies 100% on other people to take her outside because she cannot do it herself. So whether it be myself, my family members, or someone, a nurse or staff in the home, when the minute she goes out the door in her wheelchair, she squeals. Like she squeals with excitement and this joy that sometimes the laughter's, she can't breathe because she's laughing so hard because she gets so excited.
Wow.
So it's really a beautiful testament to how really beauty and the outdoors really changes you in such a profound way because I get to witness it and just to watch her evolution from being indoors and wheeling her out into the cold or the breeze and the fresh air. She just loves it.
Yeah, I didn't know very much about disability until college, when I spent some time with this community called L'Arche. It's a network of communities for people with developmental disabilities. Yeah,
I do know L'Arche very, very well. My parents were involved in Florida, actually.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, they taught me so much, and I would volunteer there, and I read all of the books by Jean Vanier, Henry Nouwen, and they were very transformative for me. And yeah, and this sort of insight that they have, that the people who are the most vulnerable, the most rejected among us can be our greatest teachers, right? And one of my recent podcast guests, Esther Blasquez Blanco in Spain, has a story about her brother, who is also severely developmentally disabled, being sort of her greatest leadership teacher, who taught her that the true leader is the person who wants to know your name, who wants to know who you are, right? And so there's the kind of beauty that comes with having these occasions to get a different glimpse into our humanity.
That is so true.
I'm curious about your family life growing up. Were you all very outdoorsy, or like, how did you get your sort of biophilia? Where does that come from?
Yeah, that's funny, because I always say it. Just I'm a simple girl from the Bronx that fell in love with nature. So I grew up in the concrete jungle of the Bronx, really. But it was because of my family's love of the outdoors that we would be playing outside all the time. I mean, granted, some of the outside time would be on cement pavements. I mean, that was all we really had. Even our schoolyard was cement. Around the, you know, a wall of just cold and fencing, metal fencing. But my mom and dad would always take myself and my little sister and my twin, when we were young enough, to the botanical gardens in the Bronx, or the Bronx Zoo, or Central Park in New York City. So thankfully to them, if it weren't for them, I probably wouldn't have had this exposure and this love of the cold and the heat and the changing of the seasons, which I really attest to them.
Tell us about the tent living. You spend every summer in a tent, right? Which is really, I mean, what is this, and how did this come about? It was so fascinating to read about that.
I get a lot of questions about the tent life, which is a bit funny, because a lot of people now in the past, especially since the pandemic, are very interested in like van life or outdoor living. But we've had this tent in my family for almost 35 years next summer. So it's a very small town called Ocean Grove, New Jersey, which is a very historic town that's been there since 1855, 59. And the town was formed by Methodist campers, if you will. They wanted to set up a place where they could, you know, grow a community. And they found this town and they established it as Ocean Grove, and they formed tents. And the town grew. And I think at one point there were 400 tents. There are only 114 left right now. And the town is beautiful. It's like stepping back in time, where they have a very old Victorian homes. The homes are closer together and they're closer to the street. I say it's like one of the very first wellness communities, because everything about this town is what makes us that human connection to, we're closer together. So we get to know our neighbors better. The homes are closer to the street. So you wave to people that go by, and you're talking to one another. You see the people, and the tents that are there have been there since the 1800s. And the tents are only open from May 15th to September 15th. And we have a cabin. So the tent is usually like a 20-foot by 20-foot structure. Okay. It's attached to the cabin in the back. And the cabin has a kitchen, bathroom, and living room. And there is electricity and there is Wi-Fi. So we have all the creatures, you know, creature comforts of home, just in a smaller space. It's really special.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. No, that's super fascinating. You know, I grew up in the Middle East. I grew up in mostly in Oman, and I did spend a lot of time outdoors, but it's not, I don't have pleasant memories. I'm just curious as to, I mean, I was growing up in the desert, and it was scorching heat, and I remember, you know, regularly being sunburned and being caked in sweat. And so I wonder if I want to ask you how you got into this sort of this field of encouraging people to walk in nature, but I'm just curious as to whether you've always had this affinity for being outdoors, or were there, because I think I read somewhere you burn very easily. So how did you find it challenging?
It's this Irish, or were there things, you know, that, Brandon?
Yeah.
I burn very, very easily. So I was a lifeguard as a kid, and I was called tomboy as a kid. So I love the outdoors. So that was the phrase back, you know, in the 70s and 80s, was a tomboy. And I love to play dress up, but my friends, I had a lot of male friends, and we would always be doing sports outside. And then it kept growing, and I loved to be involved. I've done a lot of marathons and triathlons, and every sport I could try, I tried. Tennis and soccer and archery, and I really did love it. I loved orienteering, getting myself, you know, and just trying to get lost in the woods. So it was a time for exploration for me. So I really enjoyed it. I didn't really fear it. I loved the cold. I always loved to be cold. The heat, I lived in Florida for 15 years, so I know what the heat is like, but I really prefer the cold, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah. That's great. Yeah. I have a daughter who wants to move to Alaska because she loves the cold, and she's, if it's snowing, she's out in her shorts, and you know, it's just, I can't do it. I have very poor, my extremities get very cold. Circulation, yeah. Right? Circulation. It's just not very good. So it's just very, very funny. Tell me about your foray into the beauty industry. How did that happen? Like, how did you start your career? What led you to start Beauty Bar? And then and how did all that come about?
Yeah, I was actually in finance right out of college. Wow. So going from finance to beauty is really interesting. But my mother was a makeup artist. So I learned a lot from her about makeup artistry and color. And again, I was this tomboy, but I still loved makeup. And I quit my job at Merrill Lynch in my mid-20s. And to my parents' dismay, they said, please don't leave your 401k behind. And I decided to go out on my own. And I mean, this was in the mid to late 90s when there weren't many female entrepreneurs that I knew about. But I knew that I loved makeup, and I wanted to, let me backtrack a little bit. When I was working at Merrill Lynch, at night and on the weekends, I was interning everywhere I could to learn about makeup application for magazines, for photo shoots, for concerts. And I was just doing everything I could for free just to learn about what it was like to be on set. And I fell in love with the process of photo shoots. And again, I was doing the makeup artistry, or I was just carrying the makeup for people, or cleaning the carpets, or carrying coffee. I didn't care. I just wanted to be a part of the process so I could learn and build up a portfolio of work, of things I used to work on. And so...
What drew you to that? What, like?
I think I've always loved artistry. I loved art, and I've always loved art. And even as a child, I was always in sculpture class or art class, and drawing and sculpting and pastels. And I love artistry. Okay. And so I thought of it, I guess, as a form of artistry. And then I was able to start painting the faces. And then I was called to do some concerts at the time. It was like 98 Degrees and Jessica Simpson and Molly. Wow. Oh my gosh, I've forgotten. Not Molly. Anyway, there are lots of actors and actresses and singers I started to work with. And that's when I quit Merrill Lynch, and I was doing a lot of makeup artistry for TV production and movie production. And I started making makeup for women. There were these things that you could buy that you could actually mix makeup for people. So I go back in Avon back in the days, I would go home to home and start whipping up makeup for people in their kitchens. So that was the beginning of wanting to get more involved in makeup. And then on a fluke, a friend of mine was a TV producer in ABC affiliate. I was living in Florida at the time. And he knew that I was doing makeup artistry for these artists. And he said, I need you to come on air with your makeup kit and talk about what you're using on these celebrities, because our actual guest fell through. And to be honest, I cursed at him. I'm not going to say it, but I said, absolutely not. There's no way I'm going on TV to talk about that. I do the makeup for the people on TV. And, you know, this is back in the day when there weren't people really on TV except for the anchors that were on TV. So he threw me in front of the camera. I wound up saying yes. And that segment has led me down a path where I've been on TV almost 27 years every single month since. So it changed everything for me, because that segment then turned into a weekly segment. And then people were calling the studio saying, you know, why is she talking about these products? I've never heard of them. You can't find them anywhere. And this was pre-Sephora and pre-Ulta days. So you could only find products in a department store. Okay. So it kind of gave me this idea. If I could use the TV segment now as this educational tool, what if I opened a store that could be my sales channel? Yeah. And that's what I did. And everyone said, don't quit your day job. It's the dumbest idea they've ever heard. No one's going to leave a department store to buy beauty products. And I did it anyway. I had $30,000 in savings and said, I'm going to try this. And what do I have to lose? But I felt it so badly in my gut. I just felt like this would be something important and meaningful. So I took the leap and I did it in 1997.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you were, because you were making these products yourself, right? You were mixing them yourself.
At the beginning, I was. So when I opened Beauty Bar, then I was bringing in brands, very popular brands, L'Occitane, Fresh. These are very popular beauty brands that were just starting out the same time I was. So oh, wow. I was the ability to just kind of say, I'm going to sell these products. I didn't know how to sell beauty products, but I wanted to create a space, Brandon, that made people feel comfortable and welcome.
Yeah.
So I was creating a space for biophilic design without having a title for it or a word for what I was trying to describe. So I was putting in wood features, hanging up shelves where I got at Home Depot. Like everything was made from, like, I either grabbed it from my home or my parents helped me hang things from Home Depot just to decorate, hand paint to, you know, the store itself. And the business really exploded. It took around a year for people to understand what an apothecary was.
Okay.
The brands were really so new and unheard of. And I had men's products and no one had ever bought men's specific products yet. So I wasn't making any of this anymore. These were all brands that were available around the globe that I was bringing in to sell.
Okay. But you were, say more about the biophilic design. How did that component come into your sets or where else were you incorporating it?
It was interesting time because, again, I was in my 20s and I was just going off what I felt. And I really wanted a space for all to be welcome. All people of all ages, of all backgrounds, just to come and be welcome and feel comfortable and not feel like they're being sold to. But I wanted people just to be and not do. I just want people to feel like they could be there and not have to shop, but they could converse with others that were there. And it was, so I always said, like, it was like my living room. People could come in and they introduced me to out of town, you know, neighbors and friends and family members. And it was this beautiful space that was warm. I had green on the wall. As I grew the business, I opened more locations. So I was able to open or move my first store into a bigger location. And that became my flagship headquarters. And I remember, Brandon, people would come in, like experts. You know, again, I was in my late 20s, early 30s then. And they would say, you know, Jennifer, you're doing all this wrong. You're putting way too much emphasis on the space. And you should, I was shoulded to death. You should have a chandelier. You should make the walls pink. You should. And thankfully, Brandon, I didn't have any investors. So it was up to me. I could make all the decisions myself. And I was able to say, no, I feel this in my gut. I want to keep it. I want the slate walls. I want the green. I want plants. I want water features. And I had a friend of mine that worked at a radio station. So he kind of put these sound beats together that were very unique. So it was almost like binaural beats. So it was a mix of music that was very temporary, but from Europe, mixed with nature sounds and different beats that he would form. And people would say, can we buy your music? And I'd say, no, I can't sell you. I wish I could. I even have like one of the CDs still here. I still have one. But he made hundreds of them for me. So we had a very unique sound. And of course, the flagship was across the street from the beach. So we had the ocean air coming in and the scent. And it was very sensorial. The experiences were very sensorial. And every event that we threw was mixed with, you know, we were selling fragrances. Like, could we mix that with chocolates and wine that would pair with the fragrance that we were selling? So it was just a really beautiful, because I realized, Brandon, it wasn't about what I was selling. It was more about how people felt in the space, in themselves, the beauty of experiencing the beauty around them, really, and being witness to how people felt in their own skin when they felt comfortable with my staff, with me, with the neighbors that they would be there with, their pets. It was just, I felt very like it was a welcoming place for all, and especially having a twin sister with disabilities, I wanted to make sure that everyone could access. It was a gift. I felt like it was a gift to have this for myself, and I'm just so lucky that I got to live like that for as long as I did. I really enjoyed. It was hard. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was very hard to grow a business that no one had ever heard of and to try to do something new that wasn't normal or no one had really seen before. But then it became a great online business. We had multiple locations and had quite a few staff members, and we grew it, and it was really a nice time. It was really a nice time.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like it's also almost like you wanted to share a gift that you'd been given, right? And it went to make, I mean, that this whole desire to make other people feel welcome is, I think, a reflection of you can't make other people feel welcome unless you yourself feel at home, right? And so there is a sense in which what you want to convey is a gift rather than create some kind of gimmick, right? That'll make people buy more stuff.
And yes. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Exactly.
Did you lose something in the transition to the online space then? Like, were you still able to create some kind of hospitable...
Yeah, it was actually, so I had the online space just a year after I opened. So thankfully, my little sister at the time had a boyfriend that was very, I mean, again, this was late 90s, and everything was so new. And so there really wasn't anything online yet. So we were one of the very first online retailers of beauty. So growing that was kind of in tandem with the store itself. So I was able to kind of storytell. And I was very, I love photography. I love art. So I was always taking photos of the products I'd sell and put them in different ways. So then the brand started hiring me to either buy our photography or use our photography in their ad campaigns because they love them so much. So it's all about storytelling. I always say I never sold a thing in my life. I just told stories all day long. So it was really fun. You know, people resonated with certain things because I said, oh, this was created in the French, you know, in Switzerland, or this was a lavender field in France, and it was created by those who are blind. And that's why the packaging has Braille on it. And so when people resonated with stories, it just, it changed the whole, you know, dynamic of why. So when people really know the story of where they come from and why, it changes everything.
Wow. Wow. Fantastic. Well, talk about your journey from there to Walk with Walsh and the walking. I mean, how did that transition come about? What inspired that change?
Yeah, I was in Florida. I sold my company up to a business up here in New York. So I left my 14, 15 years living in Florida to come back. So I'm from New York originally, but here I am now at 40 years old coming back and really starting over. When I thought I was just going to be here for a year selling Beauty Bar, it was going to be a year long transition for the buyout. And that was 14 years ago. So I'm still in New York, obviously. And it was really interesting because honestly, it was a very hard time. It was the most tumultuous year of my life. Selling the company and going through a divorce and moving 1,000 miles away from what I had had. I had a great community. My family was living in Florida. What really happened was it was really hard and I was having some hard moments. So I would go for a walk in Central Park every day with my dog. And we would walk for an hour or more, depending on the day. And I really it made me feel good. I felt comforted in these walls of Central Park where I felt there were no lawyers. There's no one coming at me for anything because it was really a challenging time in my life. And I thought, oh my God, I'm 40. What am I doing? I've changed everything. And what have I done? Have I made the biggest mistake? But I knew I had to sell the company for lots of reasons. But then I worked for some CPG brands. I went overseas in Amsterdam, worked there for a client. I've consulted for brands all over the world for beauty. And how do they tell their stories? Story is really important to me. Art's very important. Yeah. And how do we feel? And I always felt like the brands that are really, they're really committed to something beautiful more than just selling a product. How do we make people feel about where they are in their lives? So what happened was I was in Central Park a lot during that year and people kept saying, how are you getting through this really challenging time? Like, what kind of drugs are you taking? And I always said it was nature. Nature was healing me just by the walking. Just by being there and being witness to the snow and the beautiful change that I was experiencing, because here I am walking through life in this new way without my family next to me, not without my husband, my stepchild, my immediate family, and getting new friends and getting my feet acclimated to this new place that was my old place, which is home. So they kind of opened the door of how good I felt. And then oddly enough, a Facebook Live came out. And I'd already been doing TV for so long. I thought, oh my gosh, I can have interviews with people in Central Park as we walk and talk about their stories. And what was really interesting was every person I talked to, we were talking about nature connection and being a healthy leader. But every single person I interviewed said, this feels so good. I never get outside. And I thought, we're talking about being a healthy leader. You're talking about nutrition and stress and cortisol levels and all these things. But nature is never part of that conversation. So I thought, okay, there's something to this. And I jumped in head first, 2016, 2017, and the rest is kind of history. I've been down this path now, really educating myself as much as I can and researching as much as I can. And then trying to share that because once you learn, you can't unlearn the power of beauty in a way that you're witnessing beauty. Like it's not just the product. So I realized beauty has always been at this core for me to really help people experience the beauty of the natural world around us, no matter where we are, no matter what kind of hardship you're going through. There is profound, moments that just take your breath away if you let it. if you just feel the gift of grace within you to give yourself permission just to be there in that moment in time.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. I recently organized a retreat, and we were in the Hill Country of Texas. And the thing that it occurred to me to start with was to immerse ourselves in this experience of givenness. Like we didn't put this here. There's a way in which, you know, the natural world is, and you know, we're part of nature. We like to separate ourselves and pretend we're not part mm-hmm. of it, but we are nature, and, you know, but we've built all these mechanisms to alienate ourselves from it. And of course there's like, you know, sunburns and mosquitoes and all kinds of other things that also don't help, but just the very fact of like being in a place where you can acknowledge and recognize, I didn't put this here, and there's something, you know, I'm made of this stuff, and to sort of, in some sense, to be back and, you know, in communion with it seems really vital. And,
it is vital. Yeah, so that's exactly like, the word. That's exactly the word. It's vital, because without it, we are not well. We are unwell.
Yeah.
And you know, brain health is such a big part of that, because we are so separate from what is life giving, what is soul giving, what is heart giving, because we're so in our four walls so often, and we're so attached to our tech that we don't give ourselves that permission to just be. And I talk about this all the time to friends of mine, to strangers, and how hard it is for people just to be quiet. And I find that fascinating, because especially since COVID, my life became very quiet here in New York City, as many did. But I really was able to witness this profound beauty in the midst of chaos during that year of taking photos. I photographed almost every day of what's the New York City, what it was like to be here. And I walked the island of Manhattan or ran it every day. And it was just... it was hard to get to walk through, but I realized that cadence between my heart and my mind and the breath I was taking, and witness like the architecture that I never really noticed as a New Yorker growing up here and coming back here. I never noticed it because we're in such a frenetic space here, that busyness of your chaos, you're running from one thing to another, but you never bear witness to the beauty that we're given in that moment.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, that peeling back of the layers, I was able to see for the first time with like brand new eyes. It was really, it was an interesting time.
Wow. Wow. Tell us about the wellness walks. What exactly do y'all do?
Yeah, it's akin to forest bathing. So if you know what forest bathing is, it's very similar to Shinrin Yoku. But I didn't want to call it, I'm not a certified forest bather, but I've studied under Dr. Lee, and I've read every one of his books. I've spoken to him on countless occasions. Dr. Lee is the one who really studied forest bathing, Shinrin Yoku, and what happens to the human body when we're exposed to certain terpenes. And I was really fascinated by his work. But I didn't think forest bathing was the right word for me to use, again, because I'm not certified. But also, I knew that my clientele is mostly here in New York City. And when you know people are asked to hug trees or touch water, I know many New Yorkers do not want to touch water or hug trees. So it's like, you know, it's baby steps, Brandon. And I was like, okay, you can touch a tree. You don't have to hug it. But you can touch the plants, touch the living things around us, because we're so afraid to touch anything. So the wellness walks were really just a way of, I kind of call them my classroom. So it's a mindfulness walk. It's a slow walk. It can be anywhere from a half an hour to 2 hours, depending on who wants to walk. But it's usually hotel groups, corporate clients, individuals, activations for brands, whether it be a shoe company or what have you, or a beauty company that want to get people outside. So it's a way for me just to kind of educate with people, like, what's happening to the human body and the brain when we do experience beauty. What is it that's bringing in this, like, this calmness that's coming over us? So thankfully, I had been studying for so long about the brain on beauty, the brain on nature, what's going on. It's been, so when I get to do that, I love hearing the oohs and ahs saying, I knew it always felt good, but no one ever told me why. So I'm basically giving them permission. That's what I feel like. I've always been just able to be that conduit to giving people permission to slow down and take witness of what they're feeling in their bodies.
You're listening to Beauty at Work. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by Templeton Religion Trust as part of a grant on the aesthetic dimensions of science. Templeton Religion Trust supports projects as well as storytelling related to projects that seek to enrich the conversation about religion. To learn more about them, visit templetonreligiontrust.org. This episode is also sponsored by the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies, a global research center located at the University of Southern California. IACS works to create dialogue, spark ideas, and sustain academic research on Catholic thought, creative imagination, and lived experience. Learn more at iacs.usc.edu. If you're enjoying the show so far, please subscribe to our podcast and take a moment to leave us a review.
Say a little bit more about the educational component and what you've learned in your journey about neuroscience. And, you know, we have some friends in common, like Anjan Chatterjee, and I'm curious to know, how you've incorporated that into your work.
Oh, absolutely. Well, when I first really started studying and researching, you know, as what you do in your work, it's one thing to say something is great, or it's one thing to say something feels good, but something totally other when you can say this is backed by science and here's the data, here's the research. Mm-hmm. So when I really started out on this journey, I was trying to find someone that I could really talk to or partner with that would be on the same kind of path that I was on. I was having a hard time finding someone that was studying the neuroscience of nature. I couldn't find anyone that was really talking about nature exposure, whether it be outside and inside. I mean, I knew there was lots of science already done, especially back in the 80s. You know, E.O. Wilson was that grand leader for all of us who took the work from Eric Fromm from the 60s, but really popularized biophilia in the 1980s through his work. And biophilia is really our innate connection to all living things and our love of life. And then biophilic design is bringing those natural elements we find outside indoors. So when I really started studying Stephen Kaplan's work, so many things that were happening, I happened to be on a panel in Italy in 2018. I was on a panel about beauty as wellness, and who was sitting next to me on the panel, but a gentleman by the name of Dr. Anjan Chatterjee. So we met in Italy, and I was listening to him speak. Here we are. I thought, oh my gosh, this is exactly the person I want to talk to more. So we became friends, and I really wanted to learn more about his work. And a few years ago, I realized he had been studying biophilic design. So he knew my work was already committed to biophilic design 20 some odd years ago. So we really understood one another, and I got to read his books and learn more about him. And now I'm just kind of doing some more things with him that we have hopefully in the works down the line for 2024, which I can share at a later time. But yeah, he's a wonderful person. He's introduced me to so many great people. And it's really, when you have the science, there's so much more that you can share. And it's important to share that knowledge, because we aren't taught in school what happens to the body when we're exposed to nature versus going through what the author Richard Louv coined nature deficit disorder. Yeah. So yeah, it's really interesting to know. And when you know, you can't unknow.
Right. Wow. Do you have these walks, the wellness walks in other cities? Is it just a New York City thing, or do you find it now? I mean, are you doing this elsewhere, or?
Yeah, they're everywhere. I did in Italy for that Global Wellness Summit. I do them all over the country right now. So a lot of the time I'm speaking around the country, around, you know, your brain on nature. And at the same time, I'll either lead a walk in the morning, or when I'm there, I lead a walk for that team. Because again, I think it's one thing to say it, but it's another thing when you experience it. So I love being able to talk about it and then take that group out for a walk either beforehand or after to say, okay, now can you feel what that's like to just be in that presence? And it's great to be in these different parts of the country to really then access what it feels like. And I was in Wisconsin a few weeks ago. I was in Colorado before that, and, you know, Florida, and the different heat and the cold. And I was in Miami last or 2 weeks ago leading a walk. So it's very different going from Wisconsin 1 week to Miami and that the shifts in temperature. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Are there places where you've struggled to appreciate the beauty?
Oh, of course. I mean, there are, and it's interesting that you say that, because, you know, there's a lot of talk about biophobia. I know Dr. Anjan talks about, you know, not all nature is, you know, beautiful. It can be scary and hard. And a lot of, there's been a lot of talk. I learned about biophobia early this year that I never really thought about, because I've been I apologize for the noise because it is New York City still.
No, it's fine. I don't,
But biophobia, I guess, is this real fear of nature. And more and more people are staying indoors. Before the pandemic, it was 93% of our time was being spent inside. And I think that's even more so now than ever before. So there's this new feeling that people are afraid of nature. They don't want to. And I understand that coming from the Bronx, when there isn't a lot of access to the natural world. So to find beauty, you have to really seek it. especially in places that are, you know, dense. You know, there's like food deserts. It's kind of like there are deserts of, there isn't enough nature in some places. So, and people are fearful of what's around that corner, or I don't want to walk through that park because it's a certain time of day that could be dangerous. So I understand when people are having, so when I walk in certain places and I'm like, I'm seeking the places where people are not going to be turned off by all the noise and the sound of the traffic, and you have to kind of find it. You have to look for it.
Yeah. 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 And it takes a lot of, I mean, you know, I mean, cities have to really value that and prioritize that right into urban design. And it's
100%. Absolutely. And it benefits the customers. It benefits the employees when biophilic design is involved. And of course it benefits the community because it's beautiful. You know, you can't tell, you don't have to tell someone it's beautiful. You feel it. You feel when a place is beautiful, you feel when a person is beautiful, not by just by what they look like, but how they make you feel. That's real beauty. That's real beauty.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been, you know, another place where, you know, I've been encountering some of this is, you know, I've been doing some research on scientists. We did this big study in a number of countries looking at where scientists encounter beauty in their work, and, you know, workplaces, right? Or another, you know, we spend 12 to 14 or even longer hours a day in workplaces, and scientists especially who are, you know, bench scientists are in these dark, dingy basements with no access to natural light or to plants or anything. And, you know, so it helps if you're on a campus that has, you know, some sort of verdant, environments, but often they're not. And there, we had a lot of complaints about just being in a concrete jungle and ugly buildings and no sunlight and feeling like you have no idea what time of day it is. Yeah. And they're well aware that it's affecting their mental health. It's just very clear that this is not good in the long run. So, you know, it's unfortunate a lot of our workplaces
They're not. Thankfully, I think there's a lot more awareness, and there are changes that are happening. I mean, I know you see that in your work with architects, I should say, and what they're doing for city planning. And we have our podcast, Biophilic Solutions, where we talk about these city planners and what are they doing? How are they making changes? So that way, everyone from young children to seniors can benefit from this more nature exposure and not be afraid of getting outside and not being afraid of the colder months ahead. I feel like there's so many people, there's this interesting, like I hear it here in New York City, this anger that winter's here. I hear it almost like this screaming at the top of the lungs that people are mad that winter's here. Yet in Colorado, they celebrate it. They can't wait because they get to be outside and enjoy the seasons. But here, for some reason, I'm hearing it more and more louder and louder that they're fighting. Uh-huh. People are fighting the seasonal change as if it's never happened before. So, you know, how do we equip these people to be able to understand a little bit more about, like, so where is that coming from? Is it coming from a cultural thing? Like, I'm Irish. I like the cold, the damp, the wet. Some people might be from India and they like the warmer, dry conditions. So I like to peel back the layers of where is this coming from? Is it a cultural thing? Is it in your family that your parents didn't take you out, or you just didn't like where you grew up, or, you know, it's just interesting to peel back the layers of why people feel the way they feel about the changing of the seasons and the wintering, I like to say.
Yeah. Do you have then some recommendations for people who are, say, maybe biophobic, you know, say, I would imagine, you know, like a summer or fall or a spring day is more easy to appreciate, I suppose, than sort of a cold right now here. It's cold and rainy, but especially if you're in a city and, you know, you're in, you know, New York or DC in November, December, January. What do you recommend? How do you what kinds of tips can you give people to help them in those times?
Yeah, it is that the time of the year where people just want to go inside and get cozy, and I'm all for it.
Yeah.
But what I do suggest for people, because it is getting, you know, lighter in the morning, it's darker in the morning, I should say. But if you can get some early morning sunlight on your body, if you can go outside with whether you have a dog or if you have something else, I apologize. That's ringing. So if you can just get some sunlight early in the morning, that's really, really helpful. I know it sounds crazy too. Fresh air is really, really important. Mm. So if you can get some fresh air throughout the day, whether it be if you, again, have a dog, or if you're at work, if you're able to just get a quick walk around the block or go to a sunlit room in your office or your home, the sunlight really plays a very big part of how you feel. I mean, you know that as well in your work. Sunlight really plays a big part of our circadian rhythm, how much we're sleeping at night. So if you can get that sunlight, bring more nature in your space. Can you have some more plants? Also bringing sounds of nature in, because here I had that ringing bell that I couldn't shut off. That was my doorman. We have honking horns and jackhammers. So how do we protect our space with music or sound that's more natureful? I love the sound of a fireplace. So I play on my television, YouTube, the fireplace. So I can hear the crackling sounds and I can see it. I can't smell it, but at least that's that visual and the sound. So whatever might soothe your space is really important as well to make you feel a little more connected to nature, whether it be maybe a beach sound or a beach visual. Roaring river, whatever it might be that really calms you and really relaxes you, also will help you get through these months that seem to be darker. It's really, really important.
That's great. You have another initiative called The Lost Art of Being Human. Could you talk about that?
So this was an idea. Well, you know, it was these conversations that I've been having the past year of people keep speaking about humanity and being human and not really a fear for the unknown of the future, but there is this uncertainty of what AI is going to bring with it. Incredible technology, incredible feats of hopefully helping us with so many things. But at the same time, it's that unknown variable that people are a little worried about. So I thought, well, wouldn't it be nice to have a place where people can feel safe and have conversations and come together on what it means to be human, which I think is a connection to one another together. We need to be back together again. Well, I love technology and I get to do this with you now. I think it's important that we witness one another in the space of uncertainty and give each other grace to get through things and have hard conversations and not judge. I think there's such a speed to judge right now instead of just hearing people and listen to people from where they're coming from and just have open conversations. But I really want to show the people, products, places, and spaces that are reconnecting us to ourselves, that make us feel good, that are inspiring, that are beautiful. And that are uplifting. So that's really going to be the place. And we're going to have a lot more immersive experiences going forward. We started creating recharge rooms back in 2018. Okay. So we almost, it was almost like having my tent in indoors. So I took my tent life and brought it into activations and people could come from their offices for 10 or 15 minutes and sit in the tent, listen to nature sounds, and then go back to their desk. So we're going to be doing a lot more of that again in 2024. So Lost Art of Being Human Lab is just a connection of humanness to the beauty of the world around us.
Okay, amazing. Yeah. Well, the need for connection, I think, is another really critical thing, right? To connect to each other.
Yes.
Connecting to nature, connecting to each other, I think you're right. It is a lost art. And I think we're really struggling.
Yeah, we are. The loneliness, the struggle, I see it every day. Here with young people in New York City, older people in New York City, there's this uncertainty and that lack of connection really harms us. So if we can even help those that are more in need. I think whenever I'm feeling down on myself for whatever reason, I think what I try and do is go to the local senior home or go help the pets or whatever I can do to help someone else. That always helps, you know, alleviate that sense of maybe a sad day I'm having or a lonely day or whatever I might be going through. How do I help someone else to alleviate their pain makes me then in turn feel, you know, content.
Yeah. That's amazing. I mean, looking back on, all of these different initiatives you've done, it seems the word beauty takes on some different valences. Do you have a sort of a common thread that you see running through it all as to what beauty means, looking back on everything, what beauty means to you and why you think it matters and ought to matter?
I think beauty is everything. But I think it's interesting being in the beauty world for 25 plus years. Beauty is always about this thing that we sell or we buy and how it makes us, you know, what are we putting on our face or our skin? But to me, beauty has always been how we treat one another and how we feel when we're in presence. Like that is so beautiful to me when you can witness someone else's gift of their life. They're giving their gift of, whether it be a song, dance, music, their joy, storytelling, the gift of maybe cooking. I think there's so many beautiful moments in life that we overlook as just the mundane, but there's so many beautiful moments just to even like sitting quietly and watching a sunrise or a sunset or just seeing these beautiful moments play out around us. That to me is what life is all about. It's this experiencing and being the recipient of that beauty is what is like, oh my God, it moves you to tears because life is beautiful. It is hard. It is messy. It is not easy. But if you can also step back and say, wow, that was that was a beautiful conversation I just had, or that was a beautiful moment I just had, or I just witnessed something beautiful between two people on the passing of a street. There's this woman who lives in my neighborhood. I don't know her name. I don't know who she is, but she has to be in her 90s. And I love watching her. I pass her once in a while, and she's always looks just, her hair is coiffed beautifully and has her lipstick and blush on, and just looks, she's always smiling. Every time I pass her by, she just looks beautiful and radiant because she's always smiling, and just, she just looks happy. And that makes me happy seeing others, because we all should be there for each other to kind of help each other get by. And I think the beauty is that doorway to feeling good within our own bodies, no matter what's happening around us. It helps us put this, the word I'm looking for, but kind of help us put the spot of like, okay, I'm okay right now in this moment. Let me be present and just be thankful for it. We don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, so we need to be thankful for what we have today.
Yeah, you know, that's great. There is, you know, there is an aspect of beauty, I wonder, which might be linked to hope, right? Which I think of, you know, examples like this, Edi Rama, the former mayor of Tirana in Albania, who used to, you know, paint these buildings bright orange, you know, when they were just coming out of the sort of the communist regime. Yes. And then people were feeling really hopeless, and just these splashes of color could instill hope in people that there could be, you know, literally a brighter future in front of them, right? And I wonder if there are ways in which you see beauty as providing potential for almost like a promise, like that there's more, and that could even pull us out of ourselves, that could, you know, yes, be transcendent, and, you know,
oh my gosh, yes, all of that. I think that's exactly what beauty does. It is that conduit to transcendence, to awe, to inspiration, that if we give ourselves the permission to stop and witness beauty. I always just say to people, like, just give yourself permission 5 minutes a day if you can. I know people have babies and family members that might be ill, and you're going through your own illness. But if you can find the pathway to just seeing beauty, even if it's just for a few minutes a day, there's a great book by Dr. Phil Tabb that wrote Thin Places. Mm. And it's really, it goes back to Celtic times of just, they call it when heaven kisses the earth. So it's like this real trend. Transformative moment where you're just, whether it be a sunrise or a sunset, just the way the sunlight comes into a room during the day and maybe cast a rainbow on the ground in your living room, you're saying, oh my gosh, it's beautiful. There's that moment of that sunlight coming in, because again, every day is different, so that sun's going to change throughout, you know, throughout the year. So
yeah,
it's just, and how we go into churches or synagogues or places of worship that make us feel inspired and moved beyond words, almost into tears, because it's so awe-inspiring. But it's a great book, and it really helps you understand the profoundness of what beauty can give to us, and not just products that we have to buy on a shelf, but really the experience of beauty in a chaotic world. How do we experience beauty in a chaotic world? We have to really bear witness to it and look for it. As long, I would say, seek beauty and you'll find it. You just have to look for it. And sometimes it just shows up on you and you're like, wow, I wasn't expecting that today. That was lovely. It was lovely. Even this conversation right now, this is such a gift. So this is beautiful to me. And I so appreciate you and your time and what you do, because you help open that doorway to what beauty. When I found out about your work, Brandon, I was so moved, because I've been in this industry for so long, but beauty's been about sales and about ROI and KPIs. And to me, that's never been beauty. Beauty is exactly what you do in your work, is to open your eyes to what life is. And that is the gift of beauty of living. Of experiencing what it means to be human in our human bodies, which sometimes are great, sometimes not so great, but it's that understanding of like, wow, we are here right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you. No, I'm really glad it resonates. I mean, I have my doubts about this entire project. I'm a sociologist. Because we're very critical. We're trained to be just super cynical and critical, and you know, just to shine a light on social problems and the injustice in the world. And so coming from that space, there's a lot like a, you know, nagging critic in my head at all times saying, this is just, you know, completely irrelevant. So I'm glad that it resonates with some people, because
it's so not irrelevant. It's so important. Yeah. And the conversations you're having are with really interesting people from across industries. And I think like the getting together and bringing these people together to have conversations about beauty, like you said, it's that hope. Beauty gives us hope that things can be better or will be better if you also be that start of it. You can be that, like, that fire start to, like, help others see beauty in new ways that really open their eyes and their hearts to opportunity.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah. It's odd for me, this entire journey started with scientists, and it was, it started with protest movements, and I was studying protest movements, and about a decade ago, started to realize, and a lot of the theory in the field at that time was that the main driver, if you want to understand what fuels social movements, you have to understand moral outrage as sort of this negative emotional shock. And that's the starting point. And I was like, I don't think that's the case. Like, I think there's something underlying that. I think you can't have a negative shock unless something positive has been disrupted, which means there's an ideal of something beautiful that has been lost and that one wants to preserve and protect and regenerate. And then the next thing I was doing was this project on scientists where I would, we had long conversations with scientists, like hearing their life stories, and they would tell us about these sacrifices they'd made for the sake of their work, and sometimes sacrificing their health and they could have been working at Google or something, and here they are working in a lab, and we asked them, why do you do it? A lot of them would say, because it's beautiful. And I did not expect that word, and so that really was for me the beginning of trying to understand, well, what does this word mean to these people, and why is it resonant, and why do I not pay attention to it?
It's unearthing, like, this thing that what is beauty to different people, and how do they experience it, and why? Like, you're right. You have, like, one thing. It's like, oh, this is ugly, but what was the beautiful side of that? There's always two sides to that of, what's awful or what's beautiful or what's, and it's different for everybody, really. But there is that underlying beauty resonates within all of us. It's just a matter of peeling back the hard layers that some of us have built around us to, like, protect maybe our heart or our body from things that might have hardened us. But children, when you see children around beautiful things like a stormy day or puddles, and they just want to lie in it. Said, yeah, right. I'm with you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't want to have to clean them after.
No, I don't want to clean the children either. No, that's the hard part. Getting them in the tub, hosing them down. That's never fun. Yeah. That's never fun.
Yeah. But yeah, no, so I think you're right. I mean, I will confess I've lost, in many ways, my kids are, they find me rather annoying for that reason, because, we have cats here just outside. They have fleas, and I don't want to go anywhere near them. Yeah. I don't want to touch them. But even if they didn't have fleas, I wouldn't want to touch them. But so I have a lot to learn, and I would like to open my heart to more biophilia. try to become more.
Yeah. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe. Knows? Yeah, but even with people, and going back to your sister again, I mean, that for me was just such a great example, and even my time with Larsh. And my mother lives with severe mental illness, and she's been living with schizophrenia for 35 plus years, and I've been learning over time slowly to see beauty right in not the kind of typical physical beauty that the beauty world, the beauty industry deals in, but the kind of beauty that you see in your sister, recognizing that kind of delight that we can find in people who we typically have marginalized and rejected. And so, I think all of that is important to highlight. And so that's kind of where I'm trying to explore all of it. And this one umbrella term, I think, gives us, a lot of traction. I think it's a really fruitful lens through which to look at all of these things and tie them together somehow. So that's kind of, what I'm hoping to do. I'm really delighted. Yeah.
Well, that story about your mother, it is so moving, because that gives you this pathway to more compassion, right? The compassion and the empathy for others that you experience in your daily life. So, having a mother who is, has needs that are intense, and that, I'm sure that's taught you a lot over your years of what do you do and how do you service her? How are you in service to your mother when she has such profound needs? And maybe, like, the same thing with my sister. How am I in service to her with her needs? And I think it's an ongoing conversation I have within my own body and my own head of, like, how do I show up for her? Even though she doesn't, I know she knows I'm there when I'm there, but she can't communicate that. But I know, like, having the presence with her makes me feel whole. Even though we can't really communicate together, I know there's this wholeness when we're together. And maybe, you know, I think your opportunity with your mother really helps you understand this wholeness that we have as humans to one another. And that is that beauty that we don't have to say words all the time. It's just being in the presence of someone else is the gift. Mm-hmm. And it's that beautiful moment that connects us to what is really important in the world. I deeply believe that.
Yeah. No, I agree. Jennifer, thank you so much. It's been such a gift, such a pleasure. Where can I direct our listeners, our viewers to learn more about your work?
Thank you. No, thank you very much for this time. I've just so enjoyed speaking with you, and I can't wait to speak more with you later, but I really appreciate this conversation, and I really love the work you do, and I can't wait to discover more of that. But I keep having these conversations, please, because I really enjoyed listening to all your recordings, and I think your work is very important, and we need more beauty in the world. So you having this and leading this conversation for more industries to be a part of, I think that then opens the door to so many others. But people can reach me on LinkedIn. I love LinkedIn. I'm just LinkedIn, the Jennifer Walsh. That's T-H-E, Jennifer Walsh. I'm on Instagram, which I love to post pictures and videos of the beauty around us. And that's also the Jennifer Walsh. And Lost Art of Being Human is lostartofbeinghuman.com. Just came out with that. So those are the best ways to really reach me right now. Thank you.
Awesome. Fantastic. Well, thank you. And I hope we can continue this conversation too.
Absolutely.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Beauty at Work. Please be sure to check out our show notes for more resources from our guest. And if you like this episode, please be sure to share it with your friends. And please leave us an honest review. We'd love to hear what you think, and it helps to get the word out about our show. Music edited by Venkat Subramaniam, and the podcast was edited by Dave Visaya from Podcast Engineers. And thanks again to our two sponsors, Templeton Religion Trust and the Institute for Advanced Catholic Studies at the University of Southern California. For a research project on beauty and science, visit wellbeingandscience.com. To learn more about our broader project on beauty at work, visit beautyatwork.net. Thanks again, and see you next time.